You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day, I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bow. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538.com. With me in the studio, it's Neil Statman Payne. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Chad.
How you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking. And ESPNW columnist and Hot Takedown's chief championship jeweler for all of our championship ring needs. It's Kate Fagan.
Hi, Chad.
Hi, Kate. Kate, where'd you learn all those jewelry skills you got?
In London.
Oh, yeah? You did a little apprenticeship overseas?
I saw the crown jewels.
Ooh. And that inspired you?
Which always
you.
Makes me feel weird.
Yeah, the crown jewels.
Yes. I learned something about 53-carat diamonds, and I think maybe it's 530. It's a lot of carats, the one that's on the scepter thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw a lot of very expensive jewelry, and that's where I learned my craft.
So when you were on quote-unquote vacation last week,
yes.
You were really just honing your craft. So that,
of course,
when we talk about on today's show, the NBA and the NHL finals, you would be well-prepared to fit whichever team won.
I'm always working.
Do NHL teams get rings, or do they just get the cup?
No, they get rings.
They get the rings.
They get
the cup.
A day with the cup.
Because the NBA also has the Larry O'Brien trophy.
Oh, which is definitely as good as the Stanley Cup and, you know,
they
aesthetically
still get rings.
Pleasing. Yeah, they get rings. The rings are more important, I do feel like, in the NBA, though.
Yeah.
So on today's show, we will be talking about the NHL Stanley Cup Finals, the Penguins versus the
Chad,
Predators.
Chad, excuse me, it's the Stanley Cup Final. It's singular, as I've learned while having to do horrible AP styling for editing these stories.
Thank you, Neil. I once knew that when I was sports editor, but it's now flitted across
good for you.
Head.
Good for you.
So the Stanley Cup Final, we will discuss the Penguins and the Predators, which is already one game old, and we'll have Washington Post Neil Greenberg on to discuss that. But first, should we just jump right in to the NBA? I'm ready.
I'm ready.
Jump right in. In the NBA. So we are where we all thought we would be. The Warriors and the Cavs are playing again for the third time. It's being cast as a trilogy in the media, which should make this finals the best one, right? There's an agreement that the third is best. No,
the second is always best, right? Think about Star Wars. Godfather is the second one.
That's true. The
third
nobody
likes.
Home Alone.
Home Alone.
Yeah. Which truly, yeah, that's
in the same
company as
Godfather and Star Wars.
That means that someone who's going to appear in this trilogy will be president someday based on the Home Alone example.
Wow.
So, Cavaliers, Warriors, let's start with the Cavs. We talked a little bit last week while you were out, Kate.
What? You guys had a podcast without
we
me?
We talked about the NBA. Imagine that. We talked a bit about the Warriors who had already qualified for the finals. So let's start with the Cavs and sort of frame this within the Cavs since it does seem as though they're the challengers even though they're defending champions. 538's win probability model gives them a 10% chance to win the NBA finals. Plural, Neil? Am I allowed?
In the NBA, I believe it is plural.
Okay, great. So,
which
Kate,
makes no freaking sense.
Kate, before we get to why that is 10%, how does that sit with you? The Cavaliers, the LeBron James-led Cavaliers, defending champion Cavaliers with a 10% chance to win.
It sits very poorly.
Why?
With me. For a number of reasons. One is and we've talked about this week in and week out, as we've all seen the win probability for the Cavs, like the title winning probability range from like 4% to now 10%.
It should have gone up much higher, you think, with all those teams out of the way.
Of course. So it sits poorly because I think Vegas probably, I think, has them at like the equivalent of like a 30% chance to win, which feels more right in my bones for the percentage chance that the Cavaliers have. I would probably put it around 20%. I think I forced Neil to answer this a couple weeks ago.
I think that's what I said, like 20, 25, something like that.
But it also sits poorly because, and there's a lot of numbers to get to about this finals, but it sits poorly because it's reflective of a very unnatural evolution in the NBA, where one team, the Cleveland Cavaliers, have broken the system in a way. They have rendered the regular season as extraneous in favor of their pursuit of the title. And so you can see even in the model that it's basing it off of these numbers that should seem nourishing to past NBA seasons, but this one is hollow, that number, and the numbers that are going into the ELO rating and that win probability model for the Cavs.
So have they broken the system, or is the system broken, is sort of the question.
Or both, right, at this point. The system was broken, and so they found the loopholes that existed in the cracks of the system.
So, Neil, what Kate's saying makes a lot of sense to me, but is it the case that by this time in the playoffs, the ELO system, the number system that we use at 538 to forecast these games, has it caught up with the Cavaliers' quote-unquote actual talent? Because there have been so many playoff games, many of them blowouts on behalf of the Cavs, who only lost one game in the lead-up to this finals, does ELO now price in their actual talent because the regular season's so far away and the teams they beat were also good, and so beating by them by a lot means a lot?
Yeah, I think mostly, maybe not like completely, just because it still has some residual, you know, impact from that late season swoon that we talked about with the Cavs. But yeah, based on how they've played in the playoffs, based on the fact that ELO does give more credit to more recent results, results against better teams, blowout results, all those things, I think the Cavs are. Boss Nate Silver wrote about this on Saturday about how the Cavs pretty much have the same ELO rating that you would expect from a conference champion sort of historically. It's pretty much at the norm for that. The reason why their odds are so low has far less to do with their own rating being low and a lot more to do with the Warriors rating just being ridiculously, ridiculously high.
So Kate, let's then spin it back to what you were just talking about, which is then it's not about the Cavs, but it's about the Warriors. And does it strike you that the Warriors are so good that 9 out of 10 times they should be winning these finals against a team as good as the Cavs?
Well, the point that their percentage chance, the Cavaliers' percentage chance, is so low to win the finals being more of a reflection of the Warriors, to me, doesn't absolve the NBA of its issues. It, in fact, reinforces them that we have two teams, 3 years in a row, both of whom have followed a very similar model of stockpiling talent, and so much talent that I don't know what the win share probability number of like the roster, and Neil can get into this, for those two teams, Cavaliers versus Warriors, being so much more ridiculously high than even very, very good NBA teams like the Rockets and the Celtics. You can maybe jump in here, Neil, with like what that means about the talent on those two teams versus those other.
Yeah, so let me just put the numbers out there real quick, and then, Neil, you can explain them to us. The Cavaliers had 0.190 win shares per 48 minutes in the playoffs. And, Neil, I'm hoping you can explain what that might mean. Whereas the Warriors had 0.194 win shares. So they're close, but at the same time, the Warriors are still better.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, by definition, because of the way win shares are set up, the more that you win, but also the more that your underlying point margins kind of inflate, the more win shares there are to go around on your team per minute and for the whole team in general. So we've talked about, I think last week, we talked about how the Warriors had the best per 100 possessions point differential of any team since 1984 in the playoffs. So like a couple points per 100, even clear of the 2001 Lakers, who had been the team that had the record for that, at least in modern history, since we can kind of track possessions for playoff games. And I believe now, after the Eastern Conference Finals wrapped up, the Cavs are second in that stat for a single playoff, and they too have gone ahead of the 2001 Lakers, which really was kind of the all-time gold standard of a team that just blew the doors off everyone in the playoffs. They famously also didn't lose a game until game one of the NBA Finals in 2001. And so we're just seeing two teams that have dominated their respective conferences, probably unlike any other combination of two teams have even come close to in NBA playoff history. And so you're going to see those crazy win share numbers because that's just how dominant both of the teams have been.
Okay, so to get back to this original point, like, I understand the Warriors' win share numbers being that high because of their performance all regular season. The Cavs, there's the win share number, and then there's also like their effective field goal percentage, right? So, and the difference between their own effective field goal percentage and the opponent's effective field goal percentage, and it being 9% difference. So
with their own offensive field goal,
their own is 59.8%. Okay. Their defensive is 50.8%. Difference of 9%. Right,
pretty good.
Pretty good. Warriors is 10.6%
margin.
Yeah, the okay. next closest is the Rockets with 1.2%. Look at me throwing out numbers that I have right in front of me that I'm trying to. But anyway, the point being the Warriors and the Cavs are so high. The Cavs specifically, 9% difference, this being a defensive team that was embarrassing towards the end of the regular season, which gets back to my original point that, like, does this mean that something is broken in the NBA model when, like, of course, there's, like, is there a course correction of some sort coming up? Because hockey, we know we have unpredictable numbers in the postseason, but it's like all baked into the model. And now something unnatural seems to be happening with the Cleveland Cavaliers, that we can't actually rely on their numbers. So what does that mean? Like, what is that
mean? Or alternatively, you're relying on past playoff numbers instead of regular season numbers, and that sort of morphed it too.
Yes, the most recent numbers are rendered meaningless.
Right, and so that suggests that maybe, you know, where the meaning is in the NBA now is in these final 2 months of the season. And as long as rosters don't change too much, obviously if the Thunder lose Durant, then that's a significant difference in how they play. But if a team has played, let's say, a full season already, then maybe what you should be really basing your assumptions are in the postseason are last year's playoffs as opposed to the regular season.
Yeah, it's to me, it's like once you figured out in a video game that there was like that little like left, up, right, you know, A, B button thing you could do to like jump ahead to levels or get extra lives, why would you then go play those levels before you would get to level 5? You would just always hit that cheat sheet code.
The warp whistle.
Or whatever it was. I forget what it was for all the games I played, but like once I figured that out, do you think I was playing levels 1 through 3? No, and that's what it feels like the Cavaliers have done here. They've realized
but
they're
still paid to play levels.
Of course, but like they do it in a way where they like have as many lives and as much of a power meter as possible once they get there.
And I mean, it's also worth pointing out that so the Cavs are defending NBA champs. The Warriors were defending NBA champs last year when they tried to defend it with a championship. And we've seen a pattern at least longer than just this current sort of big three superstar, you know, conglomeration era, whatever we want to call it, where, you know, defending champions, I mentioned the 2001 Lakers, they were a defending champion and they pretty much took most of that regular season off too before, you know, making that insane push during the playoffs also. So, I mean, there is some history. The 95 Rockets are another great example where they were, you know, hovering just barely above 500 for most of the season and then ended up dominating the playoffs again and beating a Magic team that a lot of people thought going into those finals should have been favorited over the defending champs. So I think this is not an especially new phenomenon for the NBA that a team that went so deep into the postseason the previous year would sort of pick their spots the next year and kind of have the feeling that, you know, they could flip the switch when they needed to in the playoffs the next spring.
So this brings back to sort of how these teams are actually going to play against each other, because we're sort of talking abstractly now, or until now we have. And so the Cavaliers' defense was horrible during the regular season. Have they been better this postseason? And how is that going to play out against a historically great offensive team in the Warriors?
Yeah, I mean, so the Cavs had the 10th worst defensive efficiency, whatever you want to call it, in the NBA. They allowed 110.3 points per 100 possessions during the regular season. So they've improved on that to a 108.4 defensive efficiency.
That doesn't sound like that
during the
drop,
playoffs, but it's not actually that much of a difference. And in these playoffs, which I think is very interesting, because I could be wrong about this, but I think the general rule is that efficiency tends to go down in the playoffs relative to the regular season. At least, you know, if you look at most seasons in NBA history, this season the average efficiency of teams in the playoffs has been 2 full points per 100 possession higher in the playoffs than it was during the regular season. And I don't think that's just a function of, hey, the best offensive teams just happen to make the playoffs. There's something going on here where, you know, the Cavs can play at just about the same defensive level in some ways, or maybe just only a marginally improved defensive level as they did during the regular season. And yet somehow they're gaining ground on the rest of the teams in the playoff field just by like not having it go up even more.
It, to me, whatever happens in this NBA Finals, I keep going back to like what Izzy Gutierrez, who's also ESPN, said. whatever that happens to the Cavs, we should have seen it coming. Because I can either way look at the Cavs and say, if they beat this Warriors team, how could we ever doubt a team with LeBron James on it, especially when you look back to their postseasons and the way they've increased or had a quote-unquote gear shift. Similarly, if they get blown out by the Warriors, we should see that coming as well, considering their poor play during the regular season, especially on the defensive side of the ball.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things there, just to go off of that point, is that even when LeBron has won the finals in the past or just won, you know, deep playoff series in the past, they've tended to be upsets, or at least once he's been outside of the little bubble that they've created in the Eastern Conference, so definitely in the finals, he's had to kind of either he's lost as an underdog and we sort of have to be like, well, you know, he never really had that much of a chance of winning in the first place. Look at his teammates, look at this, that, and the other. Or, like last season, he's had to kind of make this pretty incredible, sort of put the team on his back, comeback and upset just to be able to win. So I don't know how that plays into the we should have seen it coming narrative, because maybe in some ways we should not see a LeBron championship coming in most of the cases in the past.
Well, it seems to me like the arguing both sides of it is that you're arguing the narrative side versus the numbers side. And
exactly.
That it seems very evident that the Warriors are a better team than the Cavs, especially if you include the regular season numbers, which now we're maybe saying don't apply. But the narrative of LeBron world beater, which is so funny because it's totally inverted from the narrative earlier in LeBron's career where he couldn't get it done in the playoffs. But the narrative allows you to – it's like a get-out-of-jail-free card if you're wrong a little, or if you want to go against the conventional wisdom a little bit.
If you want to have – any sort of reasoning for why the Cavaliers should win this series, it's totally based on some sort of storyline that you think you can milk out of previous years. Because you can't really construct, based on rational evidence, any reason why the Cavaliers should win the NBA Finals. Unless you're saying, we're going to see something from LeBron that we haven't seen before, just like last year. That's the only really rational explanation if you're picking the Cavs. You can't say, like, well, you know, their defensive philosophy and the way they play and the pick and roll is going to be perfect against Steph Curry. I mean, there is no X's and O's basketball reason why the Cleveland Cavaliers should win.
And maybe that's a good place to end it, in the sense that, to me, what defines a superstar in a sport is that he or she defies reason and he defies logic and he's able to do things that seem to break our understanding of what could be done in a sport. And we've seen LeBron do that before, and which is why it always comes back to sort of which LeBron is going to show up for the Cavs. All right, let's leave it there, we will surely be talking about the NBA Finals next week after a few games have been played. But we'll move on to the other finals brewing. The NHL Stanley Cup Final. The Stanley Cup Final has begun. One game is already set. The Penguins won 5-3 in a truly weird game against the Nashville Predators. Here to talk about it is the Washington Post's Neil Greenberg. Neil, welcome back to Hot Takedown.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, Neil, I got to ask, that to me was one of the stranger hockey games that I've seen. It was 5-3. The Penguins shot 12 shots in the entire game at one point, going 35 minutes, I think, without taking a shot on goal. Is it just me as an outsider to hockey, or was that actually as weird as it seemed?
It was super weird, and people may have shut the game off after the first period when it was 3-0 Penguins. It's really surprising. I mean, there was a lot of weird stuff that happened, right? First, you have the Nashville goal that was taken away due to an offside. Fine. The Penguins let a 3-goal lead dissipate. Fine. The Predators decided that it wasn't easy enough for the Penguins, so they decided just to put their own goal in. Okay, great. But then, like you said, they have 12 shots on goal. They go 37 minutes without a shot on goal, which would destroy any team in most games. Almost two periods of ice time without a shot on goal. But, you know, look, this is the Penguins. This has been their MO throughout the whole season. They haven't been a particularly dominating team in terms of puck possession. They've been a very good shooting team. They have a lot of stars, obviously, starting with Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin. And they did this to the Washington Capitals, too. There was you know, there were tons of pixels dedicated to how much the Washington Capitals were the better team. They got better shots. They had more of them. They did more of this, more of that. But, you know, ultimately it comes down to the score, and the Penguins ended up winning 5-3. And this is a team that when you don't take the opportunity to get the win in these circumstances, I'm not sure what circumstances you need to put the Penguins away. It's going to be very tough to beat them, I think, in this final.
Neil, is this kind of like the most extreme version of sort of the phenomenon that happens with a lot of hockey teams, which is when they're ahead, they go into the shell where they get outshot a lot and they just sort of try. They almost like play very differently from the style that got them the lead and end up, you know, just bleeding all these shots on defense and not really getting many back at the other end. And also, is that the right way to play? Shouldn't you play the way that got you the 3-0 lead in the first place?
Well, you know, as I said, we talked a little bit about the 3-0 lead. One was the own goal, but you're exactly right. When teams get ahead, they tend to take less shots because they do go into that defensive shell, like you said. They'll do a lot to prevent shots more than get shots on their own. And, you know, you got to give a little bit of credit to the Predators. They threw a lot of pucks at net. Who knows what would have happened if PK Subban's goal was upheld, had Forsberg skate been on the right side of the line. But, the Penguins in particular, they're probably a little bit better at playing both hockey styles than most, only because they're so deep down the middle, as I talked about with Crosby and Malkin. They're two players that can play a true 200-foot game, especially Crosby. And what we saw last night, though, was the breakouts for the Penguins not exactly as crisp as you'd like. That's credit to the Predators' defense. But I do agree with you, I also think that teams should probably pull the goalie more often than they do, or at the very least with more time on the clock, instead of just giving your team a minute when you're down two or whatever to get the game back. I mean, I'm a proponent of pull them at 5 minutes. I mean, you're in the Stanley Cup final, you have nothing to lose. But, you know, like we see in other sports, this is the type of thinking that will only go away over time, and so far we're just not there yet.
You mentioned the Predators D. In a lot of ways, the series has been billed as the Predators awesome D against the Penguins high-flying offense. What did we see in game one that gave some kind of insight into how those two sides are going to match up? Or do you think that game one was an anomaly about what we might see going forward?
I'm not sure you could take anything away from game one in terms of what the rest of the series is going to look like. I do think the Predators are in a hole, and I think it's more than just being down one game to none in this series. But I think we saw a little bit of what PK Subban could do. It's like having an extra forward out there. I think he's one of the most gifted blue liners in the league. He can carry the puck in the zone. He can run on the power play. He can play defense. He can go up against the top forwards on the other team. He could score against those forwards. He just does a lot of good things on the ice that you want your defenseman to do, especially in today's NHL, which is drifting more and more towards that offensive type of defenseman. But, you know, you also have guys like Ryan Ellis and Weber who should be able to at least keep the game close with the Penguins. The problem with the Penguins is they have, even with their injuries, they just wave after wave of lines that can score on you. And, you know, even past splitting up guys like Malkin and Crosby, you still have to deal with guys like Kunitz, and then you have, of course, Hornquist, which is one of the best players at creating havoc in front of the net. And you put in Phil Kessel in there when he's not all hopped up on hot dogs. And then you have the youngster, Jay Gunsel, who I think was probably the Conn Smythe winner, or at least leader for me, heading into this game based on what he's been doing. That's a lot of firepower that you're going to have to contend with. And, you know, the Predators they know how to play defense. I'm just not quite sure their offense can keep up with it, and it becomes more difficult if Pekka, like we saw, has an off night.
Sorry, the hot dog thing? I'm not familiar
hopped
with
hot dogs. Hot dogs. I want to know more about that.
Oh, sorry. There's a joke that Phil Kessel got run out of Toronto because he was eating too many hot dogs from a vendor that ended up not existing.
Only
and,
in hockey.
It ended up being a whole story. So that was just look, Phil Kessel is one of the better goal-scoring forwards in the league, has been for some time, but he gets maligned because of his looks and stature, and for some reason, just people don't like him. I like him.
Well, one thing on Pittsburgh, hot dogs aside, I wanted to ask, because you mentioned that they've been sort of playing with this not very puck dominant style. They've kind of seemed to sort of just get by whenever they need to. We've seen some research from people on the NBA side where they show that teams that have won the championship before do tend to kind of outperform what we'd expect just from like the basic numbers and things like that. Is there something like that in hockey? Has there ever been research on that where a team like the Penguins, who sort of has this championship experience and this pedigree, tend to be able to outperform what maybe the underlying metrics would predict of them?
Well, I think what's happening is, you know, in basketball, you have a much more robust data set. And I even remember Bill James writing about this in one of the baseball abstracts back in the 80s, where, you know, championship teams by nature have a lot of things that go right. Like, you can't win a title without getting on some sort of hot streak, especially towards the end of the season and in the postseason. But, you know, in terms of hockey, there's a gravitation towards more parity in terms of puck possession. So I think we're seeing now, and this will probably would bear out over the past couple of years, is that when you have a team that can finish, right? I think there's been this belief that if you have a team that shoots, that has an over above average shooting percentage during the regular season, that they can't sustain that into the playoffs. But what they fail to take into account is that each team's baseline is different, right? And when you look at a team like Pittsburgh that has so many star players, that has good coaching, that plays a style that's predicated on the defenseman joining the rush, good at exiting the zone, carrying the puck through the neutral zone, bringing the puck into the offensive zone with controlled entry as opposed to dump-ins, you'll see that their baseline is probably higher. Now, we don't have enough data to prove that, but just based on what we've seen over the past couple of years, the teams that can play a good defensive set, that can get past the neutral zone without much incident, but still control play and finish on the other end are what's key. And I think also if you look at how Pittsburgh scores their goals, more so in the scoring chance area, close to the crease, in between the faceoff dots, that too is going to lend itself to repeatability as opposed to the way the Capitals do, for example, by contrast, which is more towards the faceoff dots, maybe up out of the scoring chance and a little bit closer to the top of the faceoff circles, which gives the goalies more time to react as opposed to a tip-in or a deflect-in.
So, Neil, real quick, I just want to ask you about Pekka Rinne, who we've spoken about before on the show, the Predators goalie. I think, Neil, you anointed him the hot goalie of the playoffs at some point in the first two rounds.
Someone wrote that story.
Someone wrote that story.
Yeah. And so,
the jinx is in. Huh?
You know, when I watch highlights of last night's game, I saw goals that I would think a goaltender should be able to catch, because they beat him on the glove side, I think, one or two times with uninterrupted views, yeah. At least a couple times. And so are we seeing a regression, or is something up with Rinne beyond just one bad game?
You know, it's tough to say over one bad game. He's certainly good enough that he can go on a hot streak and carry this Predators team over the next couple of games. And look, if you tell me that we're going to see, you know, six other games and Rinne is going to be the hero here for the Predators, I mean, I wouldn't doubt it for a minute. But again, you know, Pittsburgh is one of the more progressive teams in the NHL. And what I mean by that is they are very good at figuring out where to shoot the puck. They were one of the early adopters of analytics. They specifically told James Neal when he had him, hey, these are the two spots we want you to shoot from the ice, and he ended up having a 40-goal season. So they're very aware of what's happening on the ice, both for them and also the opposition. And I think that we're seeing that. And I think that if any team is able to take advantage of Pekka Rinne, it's going to be Pittsburgh. Now, that being said, all goaltenders have problems on the glove side. All goaltenders have problems on the top shelf. And if you look at the scouting reports, they're all going to tell you to do the same thing. But what I think works best for Pittsburgh is two things. One, you don't know who's going to be the guy to shoot. You look at some of the passes that Crosby makes, and it's just unbelievable that he's even aware that there's a skater in the vicinity, let alone able to make a tape-to-tape play that creates an open side of the net. And two, as I said, with Hornquist, they create a lot of traffic in front. it's quite possible that some of the views we see on TV aren't indicative of a clear sight line as we might think. So it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, there was more traffic in front of Rene than we can see with our naked eye. But I think he's going to have a problem. And look, let's face it, the Predators are here because of Pekka-Rinne, and they need him to play as good, if not better, as he did during the regular season as during the early parts of the playoffs when he was talked about as being a Conn Smythe winner. Even if the Predators lost the finals, they're going to need him to be every bit as good if they want to get back into this.
All right, Neil Greenberg, thanks for joining and talking us through this Stanley Cup final. I'm excited to watch.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Neil.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, now that we're done with hockey, it's only a two-segment show today because, you know, it's just a championship edition.
Super segments.
Ooh, that's nice. Championship edition. Was that like a Street Fighter variation or something?
We already talked about Mario, Kate playing Mario, and now you have to talk about Street Fighter. You know how uncomfortable I get. You said the up, down. Oh, so sorry.
Yeah, there you go, Kate.
Oh, God. As you know.
We know video games are a trigger for you, Chad.
Oh, God, it's not. Neil, now that you've tortured me, I think it's time for a significant digit when a telling number from the world of sports is delivered to us, and I believe that you, Neil Statman Payne, are the courier today.
I am, yes. So today's Sig Dig is 2.2. That is the number of wins above replacement that the injury to Mike Trout on Sunday will project to cost the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. So Trout on Sunday was sliding into second base, and he kind of caught his thumb funny on the bag, and he ended up tearing his UCL in his left thumb, and that injury typically puts a player out 6 to 8 weeks. So we got that little 2.2 stat from looking at his projection from early in the season and then taken away about 7 weeks worth.
Are you saying that the Angels will win 2.2 fewer games over the next 6 weeks than they would have if Mike Trout had not torn the UCL in his thumb?
Yeah, basically, I mean, if they replace him with a quote-unquote replacement-level player, which probably, knowing the Angels, they almost certainly will do that. So, yeah, that's kind of the general idea. And 2.2 wins above replacement seems kind of low.
So put that into perspective. So, for example, how many players are there on, the Mets, who are projected to have 2.2 wins for the rest of the season?
Oh, man, I don't know that off the top.
Let me tell you off the top of my head, because I'm happy to tell you. And that number, Neil, is zero.
No Met is adding 2.2 wins for the rest of this season. And Mike Trout will cost the Angels by being injured 2.2?
For 8 weeks.
For 6 to 8 weeks.
Six to 8 weeks, excuse me.
So the Mets are a train wreck. Somehow this became about the Mets. Yes.
Imagine
yeah,
that.
we really went there quickly. But yeah, just to kind of give you an idea about other costly injuries. So if you go back to 2010 and multiply the number of days a player was on the DL, or like the percentage of the season a player was on the DL, by his full season projected wins above replacement, then this Trout injury is the 22nd worst or most damaging, whatever you want to call it, injury, most costly injury or DL stint of the last 7 seasons and change. And what's interesting is among position players, it's only 11th, but there's a bunch of pitchers on there that have lost enormous amounts of time due to injury because of Tommy John surgery and various other things. When you whittle it down to just position players like Trout, you find that really, like, he 49 days of disabled list time from Trout is almost like a full season for a lot of other star position players, which I think is kind of telling about how great he is, and also just about how sort of, I don't know, baseball, this is the best player in baseball, and we've talked about this before, also one of the best players, if not tracking to be the best player of all time. And, you know, 2.2 wins above replacement is sort of a lot, but it's also sort of not that much when the average team wins 81 games and probably wins, 30 some odd games above a replacement level team over the course of the season. Think about other sports where, like, Peyton Manning gets injured and he, leads the Colts to 10 wins, and then the next year he's out the whole year and they win only 2 games. Now, he probably wasn't worth all of those 8 wins by himself, but in like a 16 game schedule, a difference of 8 games between one season and the next without without your quarterback is a lot different than losing 2.5 extra games without, you know, a player in a 162-game season. So it does kind of give you a little bit of a perspective. Obviously, Trout is going to hopefully come back sometime in July or before the end of July. But yeah, it's kind of interesting because it gives us a viewpoint into how the best players in each of these sports sort of are worth to their teams and how much they change their team's success rates when they get injured.
All right. Neil, thanks for that.
Thanks, Statman.
You're welcome.
I think that'll do it for this week's show, guys. What do you think?
Yeah.
Close it off?
Let's
go enjoy the sun?
That sounds good.
No, it's cloudy and rainy.
Jeez.
We'll play a little Contra instead.
Oh, my
yeah.
God. All right. Kate Fagan, thanks for talking about sports.
Thanks, Chad.
Neil Payne, thanks for talking about sports.
Thanks, Chad.
Our podcast producer is Katie Ferguson. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Martin Onebu. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. Find us on Stitcher, Downcast, any of your favorite podcasting apps. We're also on iTunes, of course, as well. Subscribe to iTunes.com/538. While you're there, be sure to review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.